Welcome to Seekers and Scholars, a podcast from the Mary Baikerty Library in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm Jonathan Eder, host of the podcast. We situate our discussion at the crossroads of spiritual quest and scholarly inquiry, which is very much at the heart of what we do at the library, and making available documentation on a rich and diverse history that illuminates the relevance of Christian Science in a wide variety of fields and aspects of human endeavor. One expression of this is the library's fellowship program, where academic and independent scholars and others have the opportunity to receive support from the library to research in our collections for a dedicated period of time on a project relevant to the content we hold. I'm very pleased to have one such scholar and past library fellow with me today for a discussion on American religion in World War II. So a big welcome to you, Dr. Kurt Peeler.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm delighted to be back.
Dr. Peeler's book, A Religious History of the American GI in World War II, was recently published by University of Nebraska Press. It provides an extraordinary survey and examination of the role of religion in the American military and, to some extent, civilian experience in World War II. Dr. Peeler is director of the Institute of World War II and the Human Experience and associate professor of history at Florida State University. He received his doctorate from Rutgers University. This is big terrain that you're covering.
Yes, it was an interesting book because it was more narrow than my first book that it started with my dissertation. I did Remembering War from the Revolution, then to the present, 1990s. I didn't do Native American conflict, but I did all the major wars. So that was a wide expanse. And I thought, well, this is a more narrow focus, but in ways was very broad because of the different issues and I had to deal with and examine.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating book, but I'm curious about this institute that you lead, the Institute of World War II and the Human Experience, because for me, at least, there is nothing that religion speaks to more than what is so deeply human in us. So I'm curious about the institute and where religion comes into play within the Institute.
Yeah, the Institute, one of the things we try to promote scholarship on World War II, so we fund visiting lectureships, prominent scholars and up-and-coming scholars come and give lectures and also engage in other ways with students. But actually, the first conference I did at Florida State, co-organized with John Corrigan of the Religion Department at FSU, was a conference on religion in World War II, very broadly cast, both national and international. Mm. And I think scholars have largely understudied the role of religion. I think we overstate the secularization of the 20th century. I think religion is really important. I was quite struck at what a marker World War II was in terms of the role of religion in war, that if you quote-unquote follow the money, we didn't really actually spend significant sums on the promotion of the free exercise of religion in the armed forces until World War II, and that was a real surprise.
Yeah, that's a very fascinating part of your book, to look at President Franklin Roosevelt and his understanding and attention to the importance of supporting religion in the armed forces.
It's interesting how I've come to projects. I was doing this ill-fated project, which I abandoned because I would have spent the rest of my life doing the research, was the American response to Nazi Germany. And I started with files related to quote-unquote church relations. Mm. And there I was just fascinated by Roosevelt's embrace of religion as important to a liberal society, but also his belief in religious pluralism, that America is strengthened by embracing freedom of conscience. And as he put it, when he gave an address to the nation on behalf of the National Council of Christians and Jews, he said, "We are people of many faiths. We have really disagreements, but all religions offer something to the national altar." Mm-hmm. And so at Rutgers in 1990, before I was on a postdoc, and I, to be honest, was desperate for a job to keep my career going.
Okay.
And the class of 1942 got talked into doing an oral history project. Stephen Ambrose had played a critical role. He was in residence at the time. He talked the class of 42 into funding an oral history project that was originally supposed to be 2 years, and it soon will be 30 years old, and in fact is a very expansive oral history program. But I started interviewing members of the class of 42, and then the class of 49, and then different Rutgers classes, and also New Jersey College women. And this is before Tom Brokaw's book came out.
Right.
And so one of my distinct memories is meeting with the class of 42. They were both my research base, but also my funders. Mm-hmm. And I remember with the executive board, certain members were skeptical about this project because they thought, I didn't do anything important, and we know everything there is to be known about World War II. And then about 2 months into the interviewing, I said, not only has my career been saved, but they have given me this incredible intellectual gift. This is a gold mine. I can't believe more people aren't doing this. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, Tom Brokaw's The Greatest Generation came out. And I think that was really important for spurring even more oral history. Early groups I interviewed from 1994 to 98, I'd got them at a good point. Many of them had just retired or were nearing retirement. They had long left the military. So a lot of them could speak really freely. But in terms of how war impacts people,
so when you came here to the Mary Baker Eddy Library to look at our collections as they pertain to this question of American religion in World War II and religious participation and the support of religion for American service people, what did you find and how did the Christian Science story sort of relate to the bigger picture?
One of the things that became very important for the Christian Science story as related to my book was the appointment of clergy. How does the armed services accommodate a religious faith that doesn't have an ordained clergy when that's central to how the military structures religious life? I thought the Army was fabulous. The chief of chaplains, William R. Arnold, on some women's issues, I'm a little more critical, but in many ways, Arnold, he's Vatican II before there's Vatican II.
So he's a couple decades in advance of that famous Vatican Council.
Yeah, I mean, Vatican II really was a fundamental change in the church, particularly its attitude towards other religion, that after Vatican II, the Catholic Church is much more open to ecumenicalism than it was pre-Vatican II. Arnold was determined that both Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Christian Scientists would have chaplains and that mm-hmm. the Army would accommodate that. Mm-hmm. And then how to accommodate that, they turned to Christian Science practitioners as the logical group.
Mm-hmm. So how did he become chief of chaplains?
He's appointed by the chief of staff, and he was the oldest serving chaplain by World War II. There were some Protestants who had misgivings having a Catholic Monsignor as chief of chaplains. Many thought he would undo favoritism. Even more sinister, it was part of Catholic power that was going to take over the world.
Right.
But I think Arnold had a lot of support from George Marshall, Army chief of staff. Arnold, he's one of those people I would have loved to meet. He was the longest serving Army chaplain. He had served in the Philippines in the early 1900s. He had served through World War I. He had served as a CCC chaplain, helping civilians who were in the work camps. He was ordained a priest, but he only briefly had been in a parish. He had largely served in the military, although he did have a stint with the circus. He also came from a real working class background. He had a union card. His father was a cigar maker. He'd learned how to make cigars. He was a union man, and he was very mm-hmm. proud of that. He seemed like the chaplain who could counsel anyone, like regardless of faith. Where I'm critical of Arnold, but he's not unique, is the majority of Christian Science practitioners in that era were women,
mm-hmm.
but only men could be chaplains.
Right.
Some Protestant chaplains for, say, denominations that had ordained women, they wrote to the Army and Navy and said, we'd like to serve. We'd like to serve WAX or WAVES. And both services said only men could be chaplains.
Mm-hmm.
With all the faiths, is how do these faiths interact with men and women from other faiths? There were bigots in the military. There were anti-Semites. There were those with anti-Catholic sentiments. There were those who were critical of Christian Science. But by and large, there was remarkable sort of effort to have mutual understanding. There was quite a bit that was learned by each other. I think one of the stories, one of the chaplains in training at Harvard in chaplain school says, you know, his roommate thought Christian Science had funny, I forgot how he put it, but they thought we blessed handkerchiefs. And he, you know, he disabused that notion. And I think it's not a perfect world. There is sectarian tension, but by and large, it's a story where people do get along in the best sense of the term.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting to me. In your book, you indicated that to be a chaplain at that point as a Christian Scientist, you needed to be a formally authorized practitioner. That was confusing to me initially because that's not the case today.
Yeah, things have changed
Then I had to do a little bit of yes. backpedaling and then realize, okay, that what was necessary as a qualification then was to be a practitioner, which would have narrowed the field that you could draw from. Well, you mentioned this kind of bigotry that could exist, and it calls to mind this one quotation from the book that does involve a Christian Scientist, and it reads as follows, quote, other commanders displayed bigotry towards chaplains of certain faiths. Chaplain Willard Walter James's commander, a Roman Catholic lieutenant colonel, pressured him to request a transfer to another unit, citing the lack of Christian Scientists available for him to serve. The lieutenant colonel asserted that a Christian Scientist chaplain was not in a position to minister to other Protestant men in giving Holy Communion. James expressed reluctance to church officials to accept a transfer, since it would give credence to the allegation that he did not meet the spiritual needs of all Protestants. In fact, James maintained that he could and did offer Holy Communion.
One of the things this story illustrates is you can have an official policy. I mean, the army is a big place, 15 million men and women.
Yeah.
And yet you can get commanders out in the field who do things that are against regulation.
Right.
The chief of chaplains and the chaplaincy viewed that any Protestant chaplain could serve other Protestants. And so this commander is going against established policy. You can have army commanders that can make your life miserable.
Mm-hmm.
But this commander was completely out of line on official policy.
So it makes me want to ask, do you think that there was a perception among certain commanders that if you were religious, you wouldn't be as good a soldier or sailor?
I think the bias was that religion was good, that it would fortify people, it would sustain people. But there were commanders who had no use for religion. I think some of this was their own personal belief.
I want to read this quote that kind of is about a perception of the divine intervening in the experience of war. And in this case, it does involve a Christian Scientist. But just to see how this story is reflective of how people thought the presence of God perhaps was manifested in war, in World War II. So it reads as follows, quote, "Did God actively intervene in the fates of men and women facing danger? There were chaplains and GIs who answered this question affirmatively. One Christian Science Army Air Force chaplain in the China-Burma-India theater flew across the Himalayas in such a fierce storm that it knocked out the radio and so badly iced the ship's wing that the pilot told the crew to don parachutes and be ready to jump. The chaplain persuaded the pilots to continue flying and to place their complete trust in God. In the words of one biography written after the war, this chaplain worked harder than ever, and they arrived at their field with only 5 minutes' worth of gas left in the tank." Working harder than ever in that biography, I think, meant praying harder than ever, holding to prayerful truths harder than ever for that Christian Science chaplain. So that's kind of a remarkable story.
It just jumped out of the pages, and it's a question I really wondered. Did men and women really believe that the divine entered into the world? And of course, there's different theological interpretations of God acting in human affairs. One of the struggles I had in doing research for this book, because I pored over not only chaplains' records, but I didn't want it to be a history of the chaplains. And chaplains are great because they're really great observers. They're well-educated.
Mm-hmm.
They're both in the military, but they're not. So they often have this critical perspective. But I was desperate to find both chaplains and also average GIs reflecting on their own views of religion. And this chaplain sort of saying the divine really entered into this. I wanted to find more of that. Religion was really important to the American GI. The majority said, even more than comradeship, prayer sustained them in the battlefield, which I was stunned at.
Yeah.
Because everyone emphasizes band of brothers, but it's religion, they say, is number one.
Sort of on the flip side, when there was real tragedy and trauma faced by these participants in the war on the American side, how is that understood in religious terms?
I think chaplains were very cognizant, and I also think the military was very cognizant that it was really important recovering of the war dead and trying to do as close as possible the rights of the different faiths was really important to GIs. When I realized war really traumatizes people was I did one of my early interviews at